From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, apologies and firings for GM's ignition switch crisis.
Repeatedly, individuals failed to disclose critical pieces of information that could have fundamentally changed the lives of those impacted by the faulty ignition switch.
We salute a Michigan World War II vet who was on the D-Day beaches interrogating Germans.
So the first call I heard on the beach was, Stern, get over here, we got too many prisoners.
And Michigan's Green Party holds its convention.
We can see in Michigan that there is not much ecological wisdom or social justice or grassroots democracy in our daily lives.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Donkeys versus elephants, Republicans versus Democrats. The two-party system in this country tends to grab most of our attention. But today on Stateside, we will hear from the Green Party of Michigan. They're holding their convention this weekend and pushing their agenda.
The key values of the Green Party are ecological wisdom, social justice, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence.
Then, why is a 14-year-old boy from Temperance, Michigan, walking 40 miles to Ann Arbor this weekend, carrying his younger brother on his back? We'll find out later in the hour. But first, two words. We failed. That was the painful self-assessment from General Motors today as GM CEO Mary Barra unveiled the findings of an internal investigation into the automaker's ignition switch crisis. Those defective switches are linked to at least 13 deaths and 47 crashes over more than a decade. Today, Barra spoke to GM employees at a town hall meeting that was broadcast around the world. Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton was at the town hall. And Tracy, this internal report done by former U.S. Attorney Anton Valukas, how bad is it?
This is just a scathing, damning document. You can see it here. It's a 315-page document that just lays out so clearly how much incompetence was involved in the failure to issue this recall, how many people dropped the ball, how many people failed to figure out what the connection between the defective ignition switch was and the accidents, when people outside the company were sending them reports telling them this is what we think happened.
And so there's no attempt to soft sell how badly this was handled.
No. If you look at the report, there's no soft sell there. And Mary Barra today, in her speech to the employees and her answers to us, the media, just came straight out and said this was a failure. This is something it's painful. It's just something we have to face. Let's make sure this doesn't happen again.
What are some of the reasons given? I mean, we certainly get the sense that there's incompetence if people were failing to connect the dots, but what other things went into this failure?
Well, one is just apparently, I find it just astonishing to find out that the engineers didn't understand how the car had been designed. The car had been designed so that when the ignition switch went into the accessory or the off mode, the airbags would also go off. The engineers apparently didn't realize that, and that's why they didn't figure that it was a safety problem. They figured it was just annoyance for customers. So they just put this on the back burner and said, this isn't that urgent an issue. And yet they kept saying it was not an urgent issue up until the very end. And then there's some discussion in the report about the culture at GM that also contributed to this. There's something called the GM salute, where, you know, somebody in a meeting crosses their arms and looks at the person they think is responsible.
Yeah.
And the GM nod, where everyone nods, having decided something has to be done. Then they leave the room and nobody does it. So that appears to also have been involved with nobody taking responsibility for this problem.
What has happened now in terms of punishment? We hear there have been firings.
15 people have been dismissed, either early retirement or just an outright firing. And of those, half were executives, not the lower level engineers. So I think GM did try to make a very good effort to find out, who, you know, all the way up the ranks, who was responsible.
And one of the most oft asked questions is, how high did the CEOs know? How high up did it go?
Mr. Veluca says it did not go up to, say, the Mark Royce or Mary Barra level, the Dan Akerson level. And all of them say also they did the first they learned about this was in late January of this year.
Now, what did Mary Barra say to employees to prove to them and to the public who's been following this that things are now different at GM?
Well, she really wants people to change the culture so much so that she says, look, you know, we all have to face this. This is painful. This is a very personal matter for every single one of us.
So if you are aware of a potential problem affecting safety or quality and you don't speak up, you're part of the problem, and that is not acceptable. If you see a problem that you don't think you and you don't believe it's being handled properly, elevate it to your supervisor. If you still don't believe it's being handled properly, contact me directly.
Tracy, how unprecedented is this in terms of a public mea culpa from a CEO?
You know, I can't think of anything this matter of fact. I can't, you know, with the big BP oil spill, you know, it was a hedging kind of apology. I really, you know, the Firestone, you know, Ford rollover debacle. I can't remember anything where the CEO says, just we failed. We failed to take your safety into consideration.
Michigan Radio's auto reporter, Tracy Samilton. Thank you, Tracy.
You're welcome.
It was a big win for Detroit's bankruptcy struggle when the state Senate okayed that $195 million rescue package earlier this week. That vote sealed the deal on the state's piece of the grand bargain. But as columnist Daniel Howes writes today in the Detroit News, this complicated, precarious deal is certainly not a reality yet. And Daniel, the spotlight now turns from Lansing to
the pension funds and the city's unions who have been waiting, I think it's fair to say, to see that all these pieces of the grand bargain fall into place. And this week, with the Senate passing the package of bills and sending it on to Governor Rick Snyder, who's made it crystal clear that he is ready to sign that legislation, the attention now turns to them. The pension funds are having both town hall meetings and board meetings this week to number one, try to answer questions. Police and fire had a meeting yesterday that lasted most of the afternoon. I had hundreds of people both in the room and online, and staffers and experts, financial experts, stayed to answer every question. And I think it broke up about 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So, but they do not expect to take this issue up until the end of next week, about a week from today at the earliest, which gives them about a month before the balloting on the grand bargain and the plan of adjustment is scheduled to end on July 11th.
And you put a good question in your column today. Who has got the credibility to help sell these retirees on the grand bargain? I like the way your Detroit News colleague Laura Berman referred, you know, this grand bargain isn't really very grand for them. So who would be your pick to help sell the retirees on this?
Well, I think you have to do a process of elimination to answer that question. I mean, it's not Governor Snyder, and he said in an interview with the news yesterday that, you know, I'm not an adequate proxy here, and he's right. His administration and the Republican leadership redrafted the emergency manager law that ultimately took the city into bankruptcy, despite the fact that he's also engineering or helping to engineer this rescue. I don't think his word is sufficient for most retirees. Mm-hmm. And I think you could go down the list. Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, I mean, he's been warning about a plan B would be much worse. Certainly not legislative leaders in Lansing. And ultimately where I think you get, and not Mike Duggan or the city council, because they're more bystanders than they are architects of this whole thing.
Right.
So now you get down to pension fund leadership and union leadership. They have their own set of issues. I mean, they certainly don't want to go out and tout this plan or acknowledge that one of the reasons that there's going to be, in the case of general retirement, there's going to be more clawbacks coming is because their predecessors were issuing checks when they shouldn't have. So there's a lot of culpability here on the part of the board members.
Is this many of whom are gone?
many of whom are gone, but the history is there.
Yeah.
And it's a very uncomfortable position for them to be in, but frankly, I think it's now their time. It's their time to lead. And because if this thing is not approved by a majority of the two classes of pensioners, it all falls apart, and there is no grand bargain.
And
that's what's important for people to understand.
And I know we have heard that. Kevin Orr couldn't have been more clear when he was talking in Lansing and in Mackinac. This is not the time for the protest vote.
No, it's not the time. And you know what? Here's the other thing. I think people are a little suspicious, pensioners. Why is it all focused on us? It's a question that we put to Kevin Orr and his people up on Mackinac last week.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, listen, there's two reasons. One is because this is where all the people are that are affected. Most of the other people that are affected by this bankruptcy are very sophisticated financial players. They know how the game works. They know what the costs are. They know what the risks are. This is what they do for a living. This is not what pensioners do for a living. In fact, none of them expected to ever be here.
Sure enough.
So one of the reasons that they're devoting so much time to this is, A, the human cost. B, they don't necessarily know the process because they're not expected to know the process. And three, what they decide is ultimately going to decide whether this grand bargain holds together or whether it falls apart. The art becomes in play again. The pensions are in play again. And we have to start all over. And, you know, the likely outcome is likely to be much worse.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The first events commemorating the Allied invasion of Europe 70 years ago are taking place in northern France. The main events happen tomorrow, but tonight a concert is scheduled to happen there, organized by Helen Patton, granddaughter of one of America's most celebrated generals, George Patton, who, of course, was instrumental in liberating Europe from the Nazis. Stateside partner and BBC host Dan Damon asked Helen Patton about her grandfather's storied military career. His various missions will be featured in a new film about his life. One of them was in Mexico.
A lot of people don't know this. When my grandfather was first active in the military, he was very much underneath Black Jack Pershing, who was the commander of the American forces during World War I. But pre-World War I, they did have a mission to go and seek out Pancho Villa, who had started off as an ally, and this may sound familiar, then became a terrorist. And my grandfather was not going to miss this mission. And he came to Pershing and he said, I'd like to join this mission. And Pershing had him set up for other things and said, I'm not so sure. And my grandfather was very insistent. And he said, well, George, we're leaving today. And my grandfather said, well, I'm ready. And his bags were packed. So he went out there and he decided that he was going to give it full bravado. And he did actually not murder or even find Pancho Villa, but he found his henchman, Julio Cardenas, and killed him and one other, and strapped them onto his vehicle and laid them to the feet of Black Jack Pershing. It's like stags, you know, at the hunt.
Astonishing. One of many, many astonishing stories. What's it like being a Patton?
Well, I think I've come up with an answer. Because I've thought about it a lot, especially this year, when you wonder, gosh, is this my life or his life? He left all of us with a piece of advice, which was, be yourself, because if you're not yourself, you're nobody. That was very strange for us Pattons, because we could never be completely ourselves. He was always with us, and his mystery and his legacy is ingrained with ours. And so I think that for me, it's been a beautiful journey in the end to establish my own voice, to express what I hope would be his esprit through a woman, frankly. I was speaking often to Susan Eisenhower about it. We're kind of the front men now, but we're women, and we seem to be appetible, and we are deliverers of our grandfather's legacy in this whole other way, and I'm fascinated with it.
What do you hope will be the outcome, the impact of the Patton concerts, Liberation and Reconciliation for Every Generation, at this time of the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings?
Well, I think Thomas Bluch, the guitarist and band leader that we've chosen, who won the Fender Prize for the best guitarist of Europe, who also happens to be German, really summed it up beautifully. We are just making music, and music is our language. People are going to simply enjoy some of the best music they've heard ever. They're going to understand peace, I think, through just being a part of the music.
What's your favorite?
Well, we're going to be promoting a new song called The Greatest Generation, which I actually commissioned. It's basically implicating all of us to thank who we have now coined as the greatest generation, but say, hey, we have got to now become the greatest generation. So here's the bridge stanza, which I would like to, you know, have as being maybe my last word. Let's take a look inside ourselves. Can we do something more? Can we be like those soldiers of 1944? Can we storm the beaches in the hearts of you and me? Reclaim our nation's soul and restore our destiny. There's nothing to
and restore our destiny. There's nothing stopping us but fear, but there's no fear that's real. It's the greatest generation's time again. Our battle is to heal.
It was the Day of Days.
Shock troops move in for the beach assault.
June 6, 1944. The Battle of Normandy began with one of the largest amphibious military assaults in history.
The most gigantic armada in history. This is the supreme moment of invasion. This is frontal assault on an entrenched enemy.
D-Day. The turning point in the war to wrestle Europe away from Hitler. Some 156,000 American, Canadian, and British troops landed along that 50-mile stretch of Normandy Beach on D-Day itself. Many thousands more poured into France in the following days, including 22-year-old Guy Stern, who had come to America from Germany in 1937. He landed in Normandy as part of an army group called the Ritchie Boys. It was a special army military intelligence unit made up of Germans, Austrians, and Czechs who had fled to the United States to escape Hitler. Most were Jewish. Guy Stern's assignment? To interrogate German prisoners. Today, this retired Wayne State University professor emeritus lives in Oakland County, and he directs the Institute of the Righteous at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills. Guy Stern, what are your memories of landing in Normandy on D-Day plus three?
We came over on a PT boat, all of us filled with hope and some fears. And the moment we landed, I heard a cry from about 100 yards away. An advanced group of our team had set up as early as D plus one, and they were swamped with prisoners. So the first call I heard on the beach was, "Stern, get over here. We got too many prisoners."
And you had to get to work.
And immediately we sat down at an improvised desk made out of crates. And a few minutes after the landing, a German artillery sergeant stood in front of me, and it was my task to interrogate him.
And Guy, tell us, how did you go about interrogating these German prisoners? What were you trying to get out of them, and how did you do it?
Yes, the situation for us at Normandy Beach was different than it would develop later on, because at Normandy Beach, we still wanted tactical information, which meant information bearing directly on the fighting. So what I wanted to get out of the artillery sergeant was the location of his artillery unit, because they were still able to shell us. And that was my task in those first moments on Omaha Beach.
Guy, as you returned to Europe, and there you are, knowing you were the only member of your family of five who had been able to get out of Europe, and there you were interrogating Germans wearing an American Army uniform, that must have led to many complicated feelings for you.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I did not know the fate of my family until about a year later. I did know that they had been deported, but at that time the so-called final solution was not generally known abroad, and we had no way of knowing that. But my feelings at that point was that they had been throughout my training, we got to get this bandit government out and restore some semblance of democracy in the country which had been our homeland.
Guy, you and the other Ritchie boys actually managed to play on the Germans' fear of falling into the hands of the Russians. And as I say this, I'm actually looking at a photo of a young Guy Stern, looking very stern, as a matter of fact, dressed in a Russian army uniform. Tell me about Commissar Krukov.
Yes. One of the most difficult interrogations, as it turned out somewhat later, we got questionnaires from the Air Force asking us about the effectiveness of a bomb strike where they did not have good aerial photography, for example, asking us where a partially destroyed factory had been relocated, what were the new landmarks, were there rail tracks leading to the main railroad lines, and information like that. Now, if you asked questions like that, no amount of deception or trying to ooze goodwill towards them would have worked. So we played on their fear that you mentioned. We found Russian prisoners which we had liberated, and we exchanged with them uniform parts, and those I put on, and from captured German prisoners, I got a lot of Russian medals, which they had taken as trophies when they had previously fought on the Russian front.
Okay.
And that disguise, mirroring a uniform that never existed in Russia, gave me the appearance of being a Russian commissar, reinforced on by a sign on my tent which said, Commissar Krukov, liaison officer in three languages.
Ah.
Also, I had a picture in my tent of Comrade Stalin, which was dedicated to Commissar Krukov. Of course, he never knew of that. One of my Russian-speaking comrades had authorized himself to do that.
So in comes a German soldier after not talking to the American interrogator and faces you.
That is correct. Later on, we found out that we had reinvented a police procedure called good cop, bad cop.
Guy, who were those soldiers that you were questioning? And I guess by that I'm asking you the fact that we have seen that black and white stereotype. We've seen that stereotype of the sneering, cruel Nazi. But did you find that there was a difference between that Nazi and the average German soldier?
Yeah, it's hard to pin down a definition of a normal or average German soldier. You had to go on the individual. Those, however, who were in SS divisions could be assumed, at least at the beginning, to be elite troops, completely ideologically predisposed towards Nazism. But among the troops, most of them simply did what they were told to do, with frequently no compunction at all when they were doing things that warfare doesn't even legalize.
Mm.
And then there were some soldiers who were really sympathetic towards the Allied cause or towards enemies of the regime, which they hated. Out of that group, we sometimes recruited trustees who worked for us in a variety of ways which we could not.
Guy, once the war ended in Europe, you searched for your family. And what did you find?
I got permission to visit my hometown, Hildesheim, near Hanover, because permission was needed. It was in the British sector. And so I went there with a friend, an army buddy, who also was on a similar quest in a different town. We drove there. I came to the ruined city, and I found one family that had been, if secretly, been loyal to our own family, and they had told me about the deportation, and that the rumors were that the Warsaw Ghetto had been either evacuated or that the people had been killed right in the Warsaw Ghetto, or some of them deported to Auschwitz. And while I cannot give definite dates of the end of my family, it's my assumption that the latter bad alternative applied.
Mm. Tell us, you're now the director of the International Institute of the Righteous at the Holocaust Memorial Center. What do you feel is your mission there?
It is twofold in the main. Number one, I feel we should understand the motivations for doing altruistic acts. And there are many theories represented by various scholars and practitioners, and so we have forums in which we explore various explanations for that kind of heroic altruistic action, which puts the fate of complete strangers ahead of your own, even of your family. And we want to know what makes people behave in this noble way. That is one aspect. The second aspect is to transmit that idealism to coming generations through our contacts with high schools and other institutions. And we are borne out that this is of interest to youngsters by the attentiveness and their goodwill in trying to absorb this type of idealism.
Guy, so many tens of thousands died on those beaches in Normandy 70 years ago. What do you think the world learned from those men who braved the bullets and shells?
I wish I could be... I was, for many years, more optimistic. But while the Holocaust, in all its horrors and its legalized slaughter of your own citizens by the government itself in that magnitude has never been repeated, in that the Holocaust is unique. We feel that we still have a lot of work to do, and my outlook is that we can, through education, promote better will, perhaps not on a global scale, but certainly in our own confines, and promote better understanding and a less prejudicial attitude towards people who are, for us, different or marginal or whatever.
A very, very tall mission. Guy Stern of Oakland County, World War II veteran, we thank you for your service in World War II, and you are now the director of the International Institute of the Righteous at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, and we thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia. Good to talk to you. Searching questions.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Green Party of Michigan is preparing for its nominating convention this weekend. Fred Vitale is the chairperson for the Green Party of Michigan. So good to have you with us.
Yes, good to be here.
Give us an idea of what is the platform for the upcoming election season.
For us, I think the focus is going to be on people,
the planet, peace over profits, to make it very short and succinct. The key values of the Green Party are ecological wisdom, social justice, grassroots democracy, and nonviolence. And we can see in Michigan that there is not much ecological wisdom or social justice or grassroots democracy in our daily lives.
In the 14 years since the Green Party has been active in Michigan, what kind of success have you seen in getting candidates actually elected?
We've had a few successes. We've had candidates elected in outstate positions. We had a candidate elected in a UP county for city clerk. We've had a candidate elected as a drain commissioner. We've had Green Party supporters elected to the Mount Pleasant City Council and to the Ann Arbor City Council, and even the mayor of Ferndale, the previous mayor of Ferndale, was a supporter of the Greens. Some of those positions are nonpartisan. So that's sort of one way to gauge our success has been the election of some candidates in some locations. I think that our other role, though, is as a advocate for social change in the electoral arena. And in that sense, I think we have played an important role. I won't say the critical role, but important role in Michigan and in the United States around issues such as gay marriage, the legalization of marijuana, around social justice issues such as the efforts to expand health care to all individuals. So I think that in that sense, we have played probably a larger role, but certainly a little harder to define or quantify in the larger political dialogue in the country
because,
and in Michigan.
Yeah, I was interested in your thoughts on how much impact, realistically, do you believe the Green Party is having on our political life here in Michigan?
Well, I think to say this, to be completely fair about it, how much impact does the desires and the will of the majority of Michiganians have on our political process? And we can see that that is not very much. It has consistently been undermined by the powers that be. We talked about the repeal of the emergency manager legislation that took place and the state passing yet another law and trying to make it repeal-proof. The same thing has happened around the initiative to stop the killing of wolves. The legislature made basically a political maneuver and so made the entire 250 or 300,000 signatures collected moot. So I think the question, you know, is both ways. Sure, what is the influence of the Green Party in the political process? But it's another way of asking the question, what is the influence of the majority of Michiganians on the political process? And I think there's been very many steps taken backwards. So we really link our growth and our influence with that of the majority of people of Michigan, both expressed through the elections and in repeal campaigns, as well as how they express themselves through the social movements that exist in the state.
Well, as chairperson for the Green Party of Michigan, you clearly believe very passionately in the party. Fred, can you spell out for us an example of a policy or something that you have supported that because of the Green Party has happened in Michigan? Basically, ways you feel the Green Party has made a difference in Michigan?
Well, certainly around the medical marijuana issue, our Greens were very active in that. Some of the lead attorneys in that campaign are well-known Green Party members. So that was certainly one campaign in which we participated, advocated for a long time, and I think the results are evident in the fact that we have medical marijuana statute and practice in the state of Michigan.
What does being green mean to you personally?
Oh, that's a good question. Being green to me really means being sensitive to the people around me, to the environment around me, to the social atmosphere in which we live, and finding every way possible to to nurture all that's good in humanity and in our environment and try to put a stop to all the things that are destroying our humanity and destroying our environment. But it's really much more about that love and sensitivity to the people around me and to the environment around me.
Fred, how does the nominating process work for the Green Party?
Well, unlike the Democratic and Republican parties, we are not allowed to conduct primary elections or participate in the primary process. So for the Green Party, we nominate our candidates for all the hundreds of partisan offices in the state will be nominated at a convention held June 7th at the International Institute in Detroit and on June 8th at the Phoenix Cafe in Hazel Park.
We've been speaking with the chairperson for the Green Party of Michigan, Fred Vitale. Fred, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fred also says the party is looking at potential candidates for the open U.S. Senate seat in Michigan, the one being vacated this year by Democrat Carl Levin. And they're looking at candidates for governor, Congress, the State House and Senate, as well as many local races across the state. Hydraulic fracturing, fracking, it's an issue that will certainly make its way into the 2014 election season. In Michigan, only a handful of communities report some sort of fracking operations. That's the process of extracting natural gas through high-volume hydraulic fracking, along with the horizontal drilling of shale deposits. In its newest report, the University of Michigan's Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, CLOSUP, takes a look at just what local leaders in Michigan think about the prospect of fracking. Program Director Tom Evacco has the results. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense in particular, how widespread is fracking in Michigan?
Well, it's pretty rare, especially when we compare it to other states like Pennsylvania or North Dakota. The Michigan DEQ reports that there have been about 58 instances of fracking since 2008 in the state, but that includes permits that are under review and so on. So it's rare, and our survey confirmed that. What we found, we estimate that about 6% of jurisdictions across the state either have fracking going on now or they have some kind of activity in the early stages. It may be the first interest shown by surveyors.
Why then is it, as you put it, an increasingly active topic of conversation?
Well, it certainly ignites passion. When it arrives in a community, what we've seen certainly in media sources across the state is a lot of concern among local citizens. And so it's a topic, I think, that really hits home for people when fracking is getting nearer to their community.
And knowing that it may not be in anything beyond maybe 6% of communities, but that doesn't mean that it isn't going to grow.
That's right. And so what we found was a lot of conversation about it, even though only about 6% of these communities say that they have some kind of activity. We estimate over a quarter of jurisdictions in the state say that it's a hot topic in their community. There's a lot of discussion about it.
So what local officials think that their constituents think about fracking?
Yeah, we asked local leaders to estimate levels of support within their communities, and what we find is low levels of support. In about 11% of jurisdictions, local leaders tell us a majority of their citizens support fracking. But in 37%, a majority would oppose it. And that's a statewide average. Now, this is fracking in their community.
In their community, yeah. Exactly. But then when you actually asked the officials themselves, what did you find?
Slightly higher levels of support, especially compared to citizens. 31% of these chief elected or chief appointed officials, mayors, city managers, county executives, and so on, 31% would support fracking in their community. 36% would oppose it.
So there is a little more support. Is that because, Tom, they're looking at what it could mean in terms of fattening the coffers and jobs and revenue?
Yeah, we asked what kind of factors are driving fracking or kind of working against it in local communities. And, you know, so when you hear about fracking on TV or you see ads or so on, a lot of the impetus behind it seems to be cleaner burning fuel, less pollution, lower energy prices, job creation, and so on. Those are not necessarily the factors that we found local leaders say are driving it in their communities. The most common factor that is kind of promoting local fracking is revenue for the landowners. Second most common is local property tax revenue for the jurisdiction.
So they are looking at the dollars and cents that could be coming in, and that therefore we're seeing that little bit wider window of acceptance.
That seems right. Yeah.
When you look at the menu of energy options in Michigan, what did you find? Where does fracking stand as compared to wind, solar, hydraulic, nuclear?
Fracking is very low in the view of local leaders. When we presented a list of different mm-hmm. potential Michigan-specific energy options, and out of the list, fracking on land is next to last that they would support. The only thing that has even less support is fracking in the Great Lakes.
Okay. So it is really – so yeah. People would say they would go for nuclear even more than fracking.
Nuclear has more support than fracking. The most popular in the view of local leaders are the various renewable sources. Solar energy is the top. 86% of local leaders would support developing additional solar. Then hydroelectric at 82% and wind power at 79%.
What could these findings contribute, do you think, to conversations in Lansing?
Well, so as we see, fracking is rare today. It's not happening in many jurisdictions, but a lot of the Lower Peninsula is within what's called the Antrim play. So it certainly is possible that it's going to spread around the state in the future. And so I think these data that we've gathered show kind of what was going to happen in various communities if it does start showing up.
A lot of NIMBY.
A lot of NIMBY. There's no question about it. There's a lot of concern among citizens and local leaders about things like risks to water resources, potential environmental damage, risk to citizen health, and so on.
Does it also strike me that the industry has a lot of bridge building to do as it moves in to eyeball certain areas? It's clear that there is a lot of suspicion and a lot of distrust.
I think that's absolutely right. And we also asked an open-ended question of local leaders if there was anything else that they mm-hmm. thought was important about fracking in their jurisdictions that we hadn't asked about already. And a few of the comments were it's a cryptic thing in their communities. It's hard to find out what's going on, even for the local leaders. And so I think that's right. I think industry, when they come into a new community, they're going to find a lot of suspicion, a lot of distrust. Some of the other comments that we got from local leaders were that some of the best things that they had seen in their community were open meetings to educate people about the process of fracking, what's involved, and so on.
Tom Evakoff of the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, close up at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks, Cindy.
My next guest will be going for a walk this weekend. Now, that might not seem that important or noteworthy, right? You might be doing the same. But starting Saturday morning, 14-year-old Hunter Gandy of Temperance is going to walk 40 miles from his junior high school to the University of Michigan campus, carrying his 7-year-old brother Braden on his back the entire way. That's because Braden has cerebral palsy, and his walker doesn't move well on grass or sandy areas or in crowds. Hunter is not walking to raise money. He wants to focus attention on the problem of mobility for kids like Braden with special needs. So, Hunter, you call this the cerebral palsy swagger?
Well, we got the idea. I was selling wristbands at my school with the student council, and we raised $350 doing that. After we were done with that, I wanted to continue to raise awareness for cerebral palsy. And we just were looking for ideas, and we came up with the idea of this walk. Then we were looking for names for it. We wanted to go something that had the name cerebral palsy in it so that people would see it. And, I mean, that'd be the first thing that sticks in their mind. And then we chose Swagger because we wanted something that'd be catchy and people would remember.
Well, and people are going to remember the fact you're going to be carrying your little brother all 40 miles. How did that evolve?
Actually, when we were thinking of ideas, my mom had a dream one night that I was going to carry my brother to raise awareness for cerebral palsy to Mackinac from my high school. And really, we just kind of went from there. I mean, obviously, we realized that that's over 300 miles, and that's a pretty large scale. And we knew that we needed to tone it down a little bit. And we have connections at Michigan. Braden goes up there. He's had several tests done, and it just kind of fits.
And you're really, it's not about raising money. What do you want to happen by carrying your little brother all these 40 miles? Who do you hope will pay attention?
Well, we are hoping to get the attention of up-and-coming engineers, therapists, and other people that will work in fields related to cerebral palsy, so that they can develop new innovative ideas in mobility assistance and different therapeutical studies.
Yeah. So what kinds of challenges have you seen Braden have to go through when your guys are all at school that made you think that, yeah, you know what, we need to make some progress in mobility. This is not where it ought to be.
Well, I mean, he loves going out for recess, and his friends play with him and cooperate well. The hard thing is, though, that his walker doesn't go well through, like, the mulch, and their playground is mostly mulched. So he has trouble getting around there, whereas if he had a walker that was better, he would be able to run around a lot faster, and it just helped a lot.
You can get the details about Hunter's Big Walk, the Cerebral Palsy Swagger. Just search for that on Facebook, Cerebral Palsy Swagger. I did it. I've liked the page. You can get all the details of this walk, about how to send them off and how to greet them at 2 Sunday afternoon at the Bonna Wrestling Center at the U of M campus. You're a great big brother, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Hunter. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and thanks for helping us spread the word.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saraday, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for listening.